Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you. Welcome to Real Recovery. It is time for another amazing testimony of what God's doing in the life of someone that has been battling addiction. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and just across the way, George P. Fraser, a man who has never had a job that included wearing a hairnet.
Actually, that's not true.
Oh, I stand corrected.
Worked in the candy factory.
Oh, yes.
Well, I was employed. I don't know how hard I worked.
Yeah. Didn't you walk out to the assembly line with a glass of milk? That's not really professional.
Gosh, you know.
You did, didn't you?
Well, I would go to grab stuff and then go on break with milk.
Yeah.
You know, you get the French burnt peanuts right out of the pan.
Yeah. How were they?
Oh, best. Fabulous.
They're still warm.
Yeah.
Oh.
Fresh.
Yeah.
Good days.
Yeah, those are good times. Well, George, we've got a good show tonight. Sean's with us in studio, and I'm looking forward to hearing his story and his journey. And before we do that, we always take a shot at one of the 12 steps of recovery. Not that they're anything more than kind of the calisthenics of recovery. If you follow these steps, that will definitely help you in your sobriety, and they're all biblically based. Not a lot of people know that.
It's a great... Great segue. And what it really is for a lot of us, we go to church, Bible study, you listen on My Faith Radio, hear a really good sermon. How do you do it? How do you apply it? And I think a lot of us, I know I did, and I still do, take real comfort hearing a sermon. Oh, gosh, it bathes me in blessing and prayer, and I feel so peace at God. But it's all in my head. How do I get it into my heart and my feet? And that's what the 12 steps do to me. And I was thinking, Billy, tonight I would like to start with step one.
Let's start with step one today.
Okay.
This morning.
Right. Yesterday.
All right. Do you want me to read it?
I got it. We admitted to God. No, that's three.
We admitted we were powerless
over drugs and alcohol. Lives were unmanageable. Sorry, that was a 66-year-old moment of a recovering addict who didn't quit in time. But the reason I wanted to talk about it is this is one I do daily all the time. And the only thing that's worked for me, I go to rehab centers, going to one now in Minnesota twice a week, and they're big fans of John Piper and John Calvin. And Calvin talked, Billy, about total depravity, that apart from God, there's nothing good in us. And some of the scripture for that is there's no one righteous, not one. Apart from me, you can do nothing, John 15:5. And what I encourage my guys to do, and I always tell them, I don't ask you to do anything that I'm not doing. George, where do you find yourself in those verses? Do you really believe it enough to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell you, Bill, that for me and my mentor, Denny, don't tell me, show me.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, what I look at is when you read about there's no one righteous, not one, and there's a way that seems right to man that ends in death. That would be good on my tombstone. And then the redemption part. Do you really believe that? Does your life show that? So if we admit we're powerless over drugs and alcohol and our life's unmanageable, one of the questions I always have is, what are you powerless over? If God is sovereign, everything that happens he allows, then our next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. You control nothing.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, though, George. In step one in recovery, you need to be humble enough to admit that something is broken inside of you, right? And then also, you have to be honest enough to say, I contributed to that brokenness. Am I off base on that?
No, I am that brokenness.
Okay.
But that's where you want to get to, and you're exactly right. And I know for me, for a long time, I claimed to be an addict alcoholic. I just was still practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And a mentor of mine who's with the Lord named Bob Johnson used to say, if I could change one word in all the steps, it would be from I admitted to I accepted. I accepted that I'm powerless. I accepted that my life's unmanageable. And the difference is knowing it and trying to do something about it. So if you really work step one, I believe, correctly, when you admit that you're powerless And that gets you into step two, where you come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity, right thinking in the truth, walking in the truth, John 14:6. You need to go to God because you realize not only can't you do it, you don't want to do it. The reason we have rehab centers, I think, is that people really don't want to quit. I know I should quit. I don't want the consequences. I don't like the life. I'm done with the pain and misery. I want somebody to fix me. Well, they can help you by giving you assignments to do. But you got to do the work. And I know the first rehab I went, and I went to three, I thought they would teach me how to use without getting into trouble. Like, if you get pulled over, here's how you beat the, you know, sobriety
test. You're not that bright, are you?
Well, I thought it was fraudulent that they're going to help me by having me quit drinking. I mean, duh. Yeah. And the reason I say you go to rehab, and I'm all for, I've worked in them forever. They helped save my life. A lot of people just quit because they don't want to do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We need a little help with that. Because really the reason you're there is you ideally want to quit, but there's a part of you that wants to keep using. It's like Romans 7, that which I want to do, I don't do. And I think what you really have to hit your knees and look at in the Bible is when it says that apart from me, you can do nothing, that sin is crouching at the door, that Satan roars around like a lion looking for somebody to devour. That is me. I am in there. Apart from him, I can do nothing. I need to put off the old. I need to put on the new. I got to be all the way in with Jesus, or I might stop the behavior, Bill, but it's not going to be good enough to stay in it.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite verses is John 10:10. The thief comes to kill, murder, and destroy, but the Son of Man comes to give us life and give it to us abundantly. That's what we wanted out of our using. And the only way you're ever going to be satisfied, you might, you know, have a long string of abstinence. That's no mood-altering chemicals, but sobriety is no mood-altering chemicals with a change in your lifestyle.
I like that. Good word tonight, George. I appreciate every time you talk about one of the steps. You have so much insight. You've had so much time thinking about it. Helping people apply that step in their life that you speak with such expertise. So I appreciate that very much. I think it's time just to take our very short break, and we'll do a little time to set up our show with our guest, Sean. He's got an incredible story to tell. He's with us now in studio. And when we come back, we're going to hear his testimony and hear his journey. So you're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We'll take a short break and be right back with our guest. Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. George, I'm looking forward to tonight. I look forward to every episode of Real Recovery, every award-winning episode. But tonight, I've got a little personal interest in tonight's story.
I like that, Bill. I never get tired of these. And it's God's story in us. And when we yield to that, good things happen.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's welcome to our program Sean. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, George and I are always interested in hearing about young Sean, what things were like when you were growing up. Where did you grow up? What part of the country? What kind of experience did you have as a family? Did you guys go to church? Did you not go to church? What was life like?
I grew up in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and lack of a better term, pretty dysfunctional family. My mother had left when I was about 8 years old with my sister, and she left my alcoholic father, who at that point in my life, my dad was my hero, and there was no way I was going with my mom anywhere, and he wasn't having that either. Shortly after she had left, I met the real man that I stayed with. It was a very confusing time because I knew that he loved me very, very much, but I didn't know anything about his drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know he had a drinking problem. I didn't know anything about that until, the episode started with him not coming home after work, showing up in the middle of the night, physical altercations, a lot of abuse, physical, emotional.
So when he came home in the middle of the night, how old were you?
I was 8.
Okay. So you're in the house by yourself?
Yes.
At 8?
Yep.
Oh boy.
I would go sometimes, you know, he was a, at that time, he was probably in his 30s, so he was doing other things in the bars. And, you know, if something happened and he had an opportunity to go someplace else for the night,
he did.
He wouldn't come home at all.
Oh, wow.
And somehow or another, you know, I'd get myself up and go to school.
That's incredible. George, I didn't even know how to respond to that. 8 years old.
It's not your normal household.
No, it's not. But the blinders came off once Mom left because you got to see the full version of Dad in his addiction.
Absolutely.
Oh. Yep. That is very sad to me.
And that's really when I was introduced to alcohol.
At eight?
At 8 years old, because he would get me up and make me drink with him.
At eight?
At 8 years old.
Oh.
Yeah. Ben had to learn how to drink.
Serious?
Ben had to learn how to fight.
Wow.
That's what... That was the... It's pretty much, at least a weekly thing. If
so
not,
I'm guessing no Little League then.
Well, that was the thing. I played sports. He was big on that.
Okay.
And but I was never good enough. You know, the thing.
Your performance never satisfied him.
Do you think your drinking hurt your Little League career?
At the time, you know.
What about the French horn? Did you play the French horn?
No, I didn't play the French horn. So. I was not in band. I was not in. It was whatever the roughest, toughest sports were.
So when you would be consuming alcohol with your father at this young age, I can't imagine it would take very much, and you were feeling very different very quickly.
Yeah, and you know, that's a part that I really couldn't elaborate on as far as what I felt, because it would usually be he'd pour me a glass out of his beer bottle.
Okay.
And I'd drink that. And then, it, you know, over a short period of time, it'd be, he'd open me a beer, you know, have a beer with Dad.
He'd have your own beer.
Beer with Dad, yeah.
Okay.
And then the weird thing would be either he would get emotional, depressed, and start crying, I'm a horrible father, or it would be, we're going down to the basement, and I'm going to teach you how to be a man, and these physical beatings would start.
Would you start, like, having boxing matches or something?
Oh, yeah.
So he would provoke you.
He would provoke me and with
like
head slaps, pushing, shoving, and then, you know, physically beat me and like you would a man in a street fight.
Wow.
Hard to imagine.
That is. 11 years of doing this show, George, I've never, ever heard this. And you haven't either. I'll speak for you.
Not on the show?
Not on this show, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm so sorry, Sean. That's really, really hard to hear.
It was...
Home is where you're supposed to feel safe and secure, not feel in danger of getting your head slapped or getting pushed around by the person you love and trust and look up to.
It was a very strange thing because I would, especially when he wasn't home, I would lay in worry, is he coming home? You know, and be scared. I'm in the house alone. And I would turn every light on in the house, every light possible before I'd go to bed. And then my bedroom, especially in the summertime, more than anything I can remember, I'll never forget it ever, the deck that you walked across to get to the back door, my bedroom window was right next to that. And all of a sudden I'd hear him pull in the driveway, and I could tell by his walk from his cowboy boots coming across the deck what tonight was going to bring.
Mm-hmm. You could tell how inebriated he was.
Yeah. And then I would lay in my room praying, please don't come in my room tonight. Please don't come in my room tonight. Because and when he did, I was asked one time by a psychologist if I was fearful of him. And I can honestly say that I was not afraid. I just always wanted it over.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if it's going to happen, let's get this over with as a little boy, you know? Because when it was over, it was over.
That's a long pause in radio, but I'm a little shocked. So let me just process this with you, Sean. The very person that you would hope would nurture and protect you and develop character in you, you were feeling threatened by. And if there was going to be a provocation or some kind of assault, the sooner the better. Let's get it over with and get it behind us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That's amazing.
It's called survival.
It is survival. No. Yep. I want to fast forward. Just, you can't see, Sean, but you're an incredibly strong, powerful guy. No question, your strength level is about 10 times that of a normal person. Is that a product of you wanting to say, one day I'm never going to be intimidated again?
Absolutely.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Any thoughts, George?
No. No. So, how did you keep going?
I kept going due to my grandparents lived about two blocks away.
Okay.
And my grandmother was just an absolute, as we've all, most of us have had that grandma that's just an angel. And my grandmother would, she was my saving grace. So I didn't see my mom. When my mom left, I didn't see her for almost 7 years. So I'd go to my grandma's to eat. I'd go, to hang out. And it was my safe place. But it was confusing as I got a little bit older, because I couldn't understand. She would always send me home, and everyone knew what he was like. My grandfather, my uncle. And my uncle would try and step in at different times, but my dad was stronger than him, mm-hmm. and a more violent man. My uncle was not a violent man at all. He was an alcoholic, but not a violent man. And but my grand, I'd say, Grandma, can I just stay here? And she'd be like, no, honey, you got to go home. And and then she'd whisper in my ear, and I will never forget it. She'd whisper in my ear, not every time, but the majority of times I'd leave, you don't have to be like them, Sean. Mm. And she was met my uncle and my dad, who were mm-hmm. both alcoholics at different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was confusing, but it was safe. But she was, that's where I got my love. And it's probably like a lot of people that are women, it's what I related to, that are in abusive relationships. I knew my dad loved me, and I loved him. He was still my everything, I just didn't, I didn't know any different. I didn't even pay attention to what my friends' families were like, and I didn't talk about what happened in my house. I didn't talk about it to anybody. There's one friend of mine who knew what went on in my house.
Mm-hmm. You didn't show up with an occasional cut on your face or a little bit of a bruise on the side of your head?
Oh, I'd show up with bruises and stuff at school.
Okay.
And things
like
this.
That ever cause anyone to ask questions or?
As a young kid and from grade school on, I always had a thing for going after the bully.
Okay.
So I was in altercations in school myself because I hated bullies.
Sure.
But as far as this is at a time you have to remember. In this day and age, all kinds of things would have been different. Teachers and everything would have seen.
Yeah.
And there would have been quite, but, this was 30 years ago, 35 years, and it was not talked about.
Did you guys go to church at all?
That was another confusing thing, a very confusing thing. My grandfather was adamant, and my dad, that I get confirmed in the Catholic Church. And it was my grandma, which was weird. My grandma was probably the most godly of anybody in my family, but my grandfather wouldn't allow her to go to church with us because she never converted to Catholicism. She was Lutheran. So it'd be me and my dad that would go to church on those occasions, the Easter, the Christmas, things like that. And then when I got turned 12, I had to start confirmation classes. And that's when I got the rudest awakening to God at that time, and probably one of the worst beatings in that small period of time, because I think it was the third or fourth time I was supposed to go. My dad came in my bedroom and says, "You got to get up. You got class today." And I looked at him and said, "I'm not going. I'm never going back there." And he said, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "This whole family, other than grandma, is going to hell. I don't want any part of this. Why are you making me go here? This is crazy. I'm not going. I'm never going back to that place. Everyone's going to hell." And he drugged me out of bed and slapped me around and dropped me off at confirmation class. And I was confirmed in the Catholic Church. I continued to go, and then as soon as I didn't have to go, I didn't go.
Mm-hmm. But you believed in God because you used to pray that he wouldn't come into your room. So
yes,
how did that line up?
You know, I don't know. There was so many things. It's like I chose, and I can tell you that I really did not, other than listening to the Ten Commandments and the stuff, for some reason, at one point, I learned, I'll never forget learning about St. Francis of Assisi. And so I picked Francis as my confirmation name. And I have a tattoo of St. Francis on my back. And he's the protector of lost souls. God has been in my life way before I was aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe wholeheartedly that God was, at the time, not letting me be afraid. You know, letting me, as a little boy, I took care of myself. You know, I don't know how I got to school every day. I don't know how I, you know, it was him. You know, who wakes...
I don't know how you woke up in the morning.
I woke up every morning. I got myself dressed and had breakfast and went to school. Wow. And
you know. So, were you playing sports? Did you start, you know, playing sports and hanging out with guys? Mm-hmm. And I imagine you didn't want to come home, so you'd do as much as you could. How old were you when you started, like, smoking pot or drinking with your friends? And
that really started, drinking with the friends started in about seventh grade.
Okay.
12 years old. Yeah, 12, 13 years old. That's when the weekend party, Friday night partying started.
Seventh grade.
Yeah.
Yep.
And where I had it more lucky than my friends, if you want to call it lucky, there wasn't any repercussions for me for drinking. We could actually drink at my house. My dad would go buy a 12-pack of beer for me and my buddies.
In seventh grade.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't...
We used to have it delivered. We're a little older, 2 years older. But
yeah.
Everybody's dead. I can share that now. Yeah. So it became part of your life. I mean, it's not a big deal. It's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an adult as a kid.
Yeah, he grew up fast.
You know, we've moved that up quick, and we're surviving, we're getting through. So did you start, as you got into junior high later, did you start doing better drugs, harder drugs to get a better buzz?
I didn't do any harder drugs. I was 21 years old, literally 21 when the first time I did cocaine.
Okay.
I drank. I smoked marijuana. I did not like marijuana. So everyone I knew and hung around. And the thing was weird is I was back in the day what you would call a partying jock. You know, I loved
hockey. George and I knew plenty of those guys.
I did.
Yeah.
You know, and that was
there were jocks and freaks.
Right.
But the problem was a lot of the jocks were freaks.
Right.
But they couldn't let anybody know.
Yeah.
So you got through high school. What'd you do then?
I think we're going to use that as a cliffhanger because that's
like that.
A great tease. Sean's our guest. We're talking to him about his amazing story. We're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. When we come back, I'm going to let George re-ask his question if he remembers it.
Yes, if he remembers it.
Yeah.
What's the over-under on that?
Not good.
Yeah.
Not good. You're listening to Real Recovery. We'll be right back. All right, we are back listening to Real Recovery. Well, George and I are hosting Real Recovery. You're listening to it, which makes us glad that you're listening. We got a great story tonight. This is unlike anything I think I've heard before, George. Sean's story is quite amazing.
You know, everybody's story is unique, and some are on a different level, for sure.
This one is.
Mm-hmm.
This one is. If you've missed any of this show so far, you're going to want to hear Sean talk about his introduction to alcohol. But now let's fast forward age 21, Sean, and now you're trying cocaine for the first time. How'd that work out?
That was love at first snort. I loved cocaine.
Why are you looking at me?
Why is he looking at you, George?
Because that was the same for me. It is. It's like, we'll be doing this again, huh?
Yes. Yeah. And I was, you know, at the time, and I was fortunate to, you know, I had a relative, I had a very, very, you know, my best friends, I had access to all I wanted. And it was immediate with me, due to maybe more of a survival mentality and things, but because of the abundance I had at my fingertips whenever I wanted it, I started dealing it right away. So I always had, you know, it's like I'm an alcoholic. I'm a recovering alcoholic. That would be my drug of choice. But what I really liked about the cocaine, I can drink and we can go for days. Mm. This is kind of weird. I tried at a period of time because I get in trouble when I drink. That's an understatement. Legal, you name it. So I decided I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm just going to do coke. And it didn't work at all.
Really?
No.
Did you start drinking to crash off the coke?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lucky guess.
I don't know how you know anything about that, George.
Well, you know, a lot of people do that. I did that. I hadn't had a drink in 3 years. I was on the California sober. I was getting high in a little pot. Nothing bad. Graduated from college. And a guy said, hey, have you tried cocaine? And no. And so that wrecked my life in 2 years completely. But it makes sense to you as an addict that your problem is drinking. So, you know, we don't want to go overboard and quit everything.
Yep.
So let's try something. And they used to tell you back in rehab, back in the old days, you will return to your drug of choice. And I found that, Sean, for me, when I'd run out of coke, and when for the first time in your life you realize that the universe turns on an hour before the sun comes up, when you're looking through the shag carpeting for rocks to yep. snort anything because you're out of coke and you're, you know, jonesing out and it's awful and the nature comes alive, you got to drink to get through that.
Yep.
It's awful.
Mm.
And so the prophecy that you will return to your drug of choice is true in that. And
yes.
that you did that too,
extremely
right?
Extremely true. Yep.
So you said that you got in trouble when you drank.
Yep.
And when you weren't drinking during a period of drinking, did you find you got in trouble also? That if you're at a non-sober period, that even when you're not drinking, there's some conflicts.
No.
Okay.
I mean, nothing when
because usually we have to hide and lie so we can drink, and that brings conflict.
Yes. Yeah. I have had times in my life that have led to relapses, many of them, where because not knowing how to cope with real life and trying to do everything myself, trying to maintain life myself without help and mm-hmm. things of that nature have led to go back to drink, have led to trouble.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
And then right to drinking.
So, you know, you start doing coke and you realize you can drink more, which you really like. How long did that go? You were about 21 when you started doing that, till you ran into some issues.
I started running into issues within the first year. Probably by the time I was 22, I was running into issues.
Yeah. Let me ask this, Sean. Is one of the issues related to violence that you grew up with?
Well, this is, I guess, to back up a little bit. Violence for me, I had many assault charges as a young person because I fought all the time. And I don't mean this in a lighthearted way or whatever. When you fight a lot, I was always fighting for the underdog, literally. But then in different areas of life, then all of a sudden there's other guys that now you're always fighting because other guys want to fight you. And you end up with this persona, and even living that life, I always knew this is, what is going on? I don't like this person. But everyone people in a sect of life are idolizing you because you're this tough guy or you're the guy not to mess with or whatever. Well, I would, and then again, this is where God comes in, and I didn't understand it. I would go home and be alone and be like, what is going on? I can't stand this. I don't like who I am. I don't want to do this anymore. But I had to because that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
So
you saw that as your identity.
Yes.
You were walking it out even though you were hating it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So but legal problems were more like the assault things and stuff, I never, which is weird to say, I didn't look at that as being in trouble. When I started getting the DWIs, check forgery charges, things of that nature, because I needed money for coke. I wanted money to party.
What happened to the dealing part?
The dealing part, it doesn't, that doesn't last long for anybody.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I know people, I knew people that seemed to make money at it. I have met, as any addict, recovering addict, I have met those people that are very wealthy from their dealing. But they don't touch it, though. They don't. They're not doing it. They're not dealing.
It's a job. It's an income source.
Mm-hmm.
The thought as an addict is, hey, this will be great. I can get some free coke. You get it fronted to you, and you wind up doing it. And then you're in the hole, and you got guys that you have to pay. This isn't somebody you negotiate with.
Yeah.
And then it's scramble time, right?
Yes, and then it's scramble time. To pay them, and also I want more.
So always more.
Yeah. And
aren't
I'm gonna
you
get
addicted to more? I am.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yep, and then it's I'm going to get, plus I'm going to front more this time, because then this time I'll actually make some money.
Going to double down.
Yeah, yeah. I can't do all of that alone. So it's a very vicious cycle.
Yeah, so I'm guessing between legal issues and the tough guy issues and everything else, you're reaching a point where you hit some bottom and you start to say, Jesus, if you don't rescue, I am going to go down.
What happened was I was dealing with DWIs and stuff at that time. What changed, well, the first time I sobered up and quit drinking, and it was a complete, as I know now,
How long ago was that?
That would have been, the first time I quit drinking was in 1989.
Okay.
And I didn't drink for about 17 years.
Wow. Wow.
Did you go
to
rehab?
An amazing run.
No. What had happened was I had my first child, and I just decided on my own, where now again I'm getting goosebumps right now because it was literally probably the biggest moment God came into my life without me being aware. I was not going to raise my child like I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know any other way to raise kids. I didn't have any, and I don't know where that came from. I do now. I didn't then. But that's when I quit drinking. And I also knew if I continued to drink, I'm going to lose everything. I'll lose my wife. I'll lose my kids. I don't want my kids ever to know a man like that. Things were very good for many years.
So how did you manage that? You just quit?
I went to AA. I started going to meetings. I spent many years going to AA.
Were you going to church, too, at that time?
Yes, we started going to church, kind of a New Age Christian church they call it New Age. That's kind of what I had needed. I was looking more for something to introduce my kids to give them a level of, you know, something but that started my walk to God was wanting to do
another
for my
failed
kids.
Attempt at yep. something other yep. than Jesus.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Everybody looks for paths. Everyone's searching for Jesus, whether they know it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times you'll look for paths that aren't quite biblical Christianity and salvation, but you'll look for things that will help you feel a little bit better, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think clinically, somebody that has 17 years total abstinence, no pot, no drugs, going to accountability groups, it's got to look pretty good.
Oh,
nobody's ever guaranteed. We just have today.
Yep.
So what happened?
What happened was in 2007 or so, was living in Arizona and married to my two daughters, and I had my own business, a construction business down there. And when it was kind of a snowball effect of things, first of all, the economy crashed in my industry, the home building. And
Was that 05, 06?
It was, yep, 06, 07.
08, yep. 09, yeah.
And it just, it very, you know, that hit. And I was living a lifestyle I never dreamed possible until that happened, and able to do things with my children that I never even thought of.
What does that mean, Sean? You're able to, like, travel or do things?
We traveled.
Adventure?
We had show horses. We
gotcha.
Had, you just, you know.
Okay.
Did you banco then? Bankrupt?
I didn't file bankruptcy, but I should have.
Okay.
I ended up losing everything.
It just goes, doesn't it?
Yep.
Through no fault of your own.
Right. Yep.
I'm guessing, right? That's just the time then with the credit.
And it's hard.
Yep.
That housing market goes up and down like a roller coaster.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So,
and how long was it till you picked up, and what were the circumstances?
After my wife moved out and we separated, because I was a very, very involved father, loved being involved in my kids' activities. My ex-wife traveled a lot, so I was, you know, kind of the main parent when it came to all that. And it was the very first weekend that I didn't have my kids, and they were with their mother. This is when I was still in Arizona. It was a Saturday morning. I got up and washed my truck and kind of did my normal Saturday thing. And then I'm like, what is going on? What am I going to do now? And out of nowhere, I'm going to go down to Scottsdale and see what life's like in these clubs. And it opened the door that I couldn't shut again for almost 6 years. Very long battle up and down and total destruction.
How do we go back to that day, that Saturday? How do we go back and stop that day? There's people listening that go, that happened to me too. How do I run that interference next time I'm in that situation? How do I speak truth to myself? Who do I call? Do I have a sponsor? What happens?
I think that what happens with most of us, since I didn't, when you were, I was, I don't want to say arrogant and cocky about life, but things were going very well. I wasn't connected at that time with AA. I wasn't connected with anything. I was doing life. And life was good.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, and literally, when the thought came to my mind, I still had some money in the bank. And I thought, we're going to have some fun.
You know, it's a great question. Talking to one of my guys this week, you got to make the calls every day. You got to put into your recovery bank account some money so you're going to pay the bill when it comes due. Because it's coming. And these guys who go, well, I didn't call you. Yeah, this time I always tell them, call me before you use. And you got to do that all the time, every day, all the way, because if it gets down to it, should I call somebody or use, you're using.
Yeah, George, I think you were saying, I remember this, you were at a bar or a golf club, and you had this nice stretch of sobriety, and you ordered like a Shirley Temple or some Cherry Coke or something.
It's in a bar. And the guy goes, you drink Shirley Temples?
Yeah,
and
they
I
made
go, no,
fun of
Scotch
you.
Scotch Rocks.
And then they made fun of you and you...
Are you making fun of me?
Of course I am.
Yeah. No, and that's right. But it's something that happened before.
Okay.
It's we have to be... Sin is crouching at the door.
Yep.
Satan roars around like a lion looking for somebody to devour. It's an everyday deal. He's got a nice stretch of sobriety.
Oh, incredible.
And the thought is, hey, you know what, God? I'll take it from here.
Mm-hmm.
I got it. And it's not a conscious thought. That's how we look at what we're doing, not what we're saying. It's what are you doing? Are you going to accountability groups? Are you in the Word? Are you praying? Mm-hmm. And it can go easy, and people go, I don't know what happened. And you've got to look back. Relapse is a process, so we can identify it and change it.
Yeah, when we come back, we're going to find out exactly what Sean did next and how Jesus led him into an amazing period of recovery that he's enjoying today. We'll be right back. Real Recovery is the name of our program. Bill and George are the hosts. Our guest is Sean, and we're hearing Sean's story. And Sean, although we understand and appreciate the depth of the past, what really makes us light up here at Real Recovery is the height of the after, and that what happens when you have a radical encounter with Jesus and how you get rescued from addiction and how you're walking it out today.
What led me to the path that I'm on now is I got to a point which I never thought I'd get to. Backtracking, my uncle, when I was 19, my uncle, my dad's brother, committed suicide due to his alcoholism.
I'm sorry.
And I found him, and he was the soft, gentle man in my life, and he's someone I could go to. And when he was gone, it was very hard on me. I can't watch movies where there's suicides and things to this day.
Did you discover your uncle?
Yes.
Were you sent out on a welfare call because no one heard from him?
I was made to go to my grandpa's house by my dad.
Okay.
But my dad knew what was in the. I know my dad knew.
Okay.
What had happened in that house, but he wouldn't go and he forced me to go over there.
Okay.
So what happened with me after imploding, after losing everything in the early 2000s, is I was on a roller coaster ride, literally from hell, where I would be sober for a year, maybe 9 months, and then crash. And I was just tearing the hearts out of my kids and myself, because my daughters didn't know Dad that drank. They were 15 and 17 when I drank. And all of a sudden, Dad's getting arrested. Dad's on the news in a motorcycle chase. Dad's just crazy things. And I got to a point where I was living in a hotel on my mom's credit card over in Woodbury. And I had a shotgun with me. And I was just doing nothing but drinking every day, drinking myself into oblivion, which happens all too often with people in addiction. And I got to the point one day where, and I was very, the week before, I want to say a week, an old sponsor of mine from way back when, from 20-some-odd years, reached out to me and heard I was in really bad shape. And he mentioned me going to Teen Challenge. And I had already been to the Salvation Army program twice, loved the program, literally. Did very well there, but there was something missing, obviously, and it's not the program's fault. It was by any means, and it's a wonderful place. It's probably, for people that really need a place to go, it's the most welcoming place there is. We can come in off the street. But in this relapse I was in, and then Joe mentioned going to Teen Challenge. He said, you really need Teen Challenge. I said, there is no reason for me to ever go to treatment again, let alone go someplace for a year. Why should I go someplace for a year? So then I can drink in a year and a month?
Mm-hmm.
I said, there's something wrong with me. I've crossed some line. I'm done. But I'm never going back to treatment again. There's no reason. I was sober for almost 20 years. I've had 3 treatments in the meantime. I'm done. And a couple of days later, I attempted suicide. And this is always very hard. I put the barrel of the shotgun in my mouth, leaned over with it in my mouth, put my finger on the trigger and pulled the trigger, and it went off next to my head. There is only God that created that situation. There's the mechanics of it. There's no way that barrel, that gun, should not have been in my mouth. I laid back on the bed, and my ears ringing, people pounding on the door of the hotel, and I was like, "What am I gonna do now? I can't even kill myself," and I moved to a different hotel the next day, and it was completely because there's nothing. Nothing's working. I can't even die. And I called Joe, and I said, "I'll try this Teen Challenge thing. I guess I'm kidding. I can't stay at the hotel anymore. I can't, you know." I went to Teen Challenge, and the second day I was there. And I really didn't know why I was there, because I really was expecting nothing at all. I didn't expect anything out of life. I wasn't looking forward to life. I didn't want to live life. But the second day I was there, my counselor sat me down in her office, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, "Sean, I'm going to be very, very honest with you." She said, "There is nothing I can teach you about sobriety. Nothing." She said, "I only have 8 years." She said, "You have twice as much sobriety as I have and have been through more." She said, "But what I can promise you, if you trust me, if you will put all of your trust in me and in the Lord, we will get you the help you need." She said, "We have a mental health department here now, and that's what you need." She said, "If you don't address your mental health, you will never, ever make it." She says, "I can guarantee you those two things. I can't teach you anything about recovery, but if you don't trust and give it basically to God and let me get you involved in our mental health program, you'll never be sober again." And I was just kind of, I was so numb. I said, "Okay, I don't know what mental health problems do I have. I'm a drunk, you know, and I've ruined my brain from alcohol." Well, long story short, I was diagnosed with traumatic PTSD from my childhood, and all of that. Things, those survival things where, you know, you deal with as children and adults even, where you don't think things are bothering you, but the body and the brain finds ways to help you survive. But at a point, scientifically, you can't hold that stuff down anymore at a certain point in your life and age. And due to the alcoholism, it was time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went, it was amazing. I spent a year seeing psychologists, dealing with therapists, dealing with doing spiritual cleansings, being released from demons and healings. And I found my relationship with Christ became so strong. And I know, I could see him in the room taking that barrel out of my mouth. And that's what has changed my life. But it was really trusting God from a point of complete emptiness.
So how are you maintaining that?
I maintain it through one of the biggest things is, and it's this is kind of, is helping others. That's my big thing, is helping others. God, I'm very, my spiritual life, I spend my time, there's nothing that takes away from my time in the morning, in the evenings, but I start every day very early, and I read the Word, I'm in the Word, I pray, I can't get enough of God, really. And
good addiction, isn't it?
It is.
It's the best.
And, you know, it's not, there's been ups and downs, there's been some challenges, you know, there's been business challenges of trying to help too much and things of that nature. But it's really that. I recovery meetings as far as, you know, AA, I haven't done a lot of those in the last couple of years. I've done more recovery.
Celebrate recovery.
Yes, celebrate recovery type things. But it's being connected.
Right. Helping others. We say on this show all the time, God doesn't save us from our addiction without having a job for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sounds like you're doing that, and that's how you do it.
Yeah, been a fantastic time together. I've enjoyed the fellowship. It's been great seeing you, and your story is amazing. So, Sean, thank you once again for doing Real Recovery.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. All right, Georgie, that's all we have for today.
It's yesterday.
Morning. Yeah, whenever. We'll look forward to our next time together. Thanks for listening and supporting Faith Radio. If you have any questions about the show, if you want to email us, you can certainly do that. You can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. I'll pass the word on to George as well. Have a great night, everyone. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.